Hey, Jason Gotz here. You're listening to Clever Creature. It's an experimental variety show and a creative leap of faith. Each episode starts with one random word. I record an audio diary entry, I write and produce a story and a song about the word, and then I sit down with a guest to talk about creativity and other things. And because I'm a 90s kid, there's a bonus track, a short guided meditation at the end of each episode. I'll share one listener comment each week, so please take a minute to rate and review us on Himalaya, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast player you're listening on. It really helps people to discover the show. Here's a comment from a listener called Prof. J.I. on iTunes. Human civilization is possible because of people like Jason Gotz. He is a riveting storyteller, an emotionally stunning musician, and an endlessly curious intellectual. He is also hilarious. This podcast is very exciting. Thanks, Prof. J.I., and thanks to you, I am also now a megalomaniac. This project is dedicated to my sister Mary Hamilton, who was so much braver than I am. Extra special thanks to my son Emre Gotz, who composed and plays the theme music. Okay, let's get going. Season 1 is 8 episodes, every other Tuesday from May to August 2020. This is episode 2, Church. Okay, week 2. I am literally recording this in a closet in the apartment that I live in Queens. I don't know why it was designed this way. I don't think a whole lot of thought went into it, but there is an absolutely tiny kitchen that I can barely cook in. And then this giant closet, which my son and I kind of share. I use it for recording, and increasingly he's taken it over as a kind of gaming cave with incredibly sophisticated game equipment, monitors and microphones and swiveling chair. So I'm in here. This is kind of a gaming cave slash creative cave, and it's a nice place to do this sort of work. I was thinking at 5 this morning, because, you know, 5 this morning when you're awake in bed is a great time to think about this sort of thing, what these monologues should be at the beginning of the show. You know, I have a little Ira Glass in my head saying everything must be polished, everything must be planned and meticulously run through an editorial team, and everything that you think is good on the first pass just isn't. And that's kind of the opposite of everything that I'm doing with this show. I mean, I think that these monologues need to be sort of a radio diary of the process of what I'm going through and thinking about as I'm making these things. And my hope with the whole thing is that there is some aspect of this, like of my doing it in this probably ramshackle, probably 85 kinds of wrong way, that is encouraging to other people who want to do similar things. Much like they say that very few people bought the Velvet Underground's first album, but most of those who did started a band. And I'm not saying I'm the Velvet Underground. Actually, this is helpful. I was just listening back to an old episode of Think Again, where David Sedaris made the point that as a writer, you know, you read all this stuff when you're young, all these great writers, your favorite writers, and then you try to be them. And then at some point you have to come to terms with the fact that you're not them, you're you. And the only kind of writing you can do is your own. Like, even if you would love to be Dostoevsky, you're never going to be Dostoevsky. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's true of this project generally. If I'm going to see it through, I'm going to have to, I guess, accept is the right word, the fact that it's going to be what it's going to be, the thing that I can make in this way. I don't know if I said this last time, there might be some redundancy in these monologues, but the structure, the kind of rules that I made for this game where I have to like get the surprise word of the day and then go ahead and write a story and a song about it puts me in the situation where I don't have a ton of time to like revise and think and do the sort of This American Life, you know, let's put this in front of a huge committee. I don't have that committee anyway. But even if I did, I'm not working in that way. I'm kind of holding a gun to my head, to put it violently, so that something gets done. And also because I think there's this tricky balance for me to maintain between play and moral seriousness or gravity on the other hand. Like, it's only playfulness that makes the work worth doing for me. I want it to be good. I want it to be meaningful. I want all of those things. But it's very easy for the life to get sucked out of it by gravity and seriousness. For me, there's a certain, I think, fear, and I think, like, based on some experience, that if I allow things to drag out too much, they'll just become too heavy, and then I won't want to do them. They'll be too sprawling, too heavy. And I have such admiration for the novelists and other artists I've talked to who can work. You know, I asked that question maybe 50 times on Think Again. Every time I talk to someone who's written some giant magisterial tome, how do you live for 5 years with something and keep it alive and lively? I'm not sure there's a clear answer to that. I think everyone's individual answer to that is different, and people evolve into that, some people have said. So for now, for me, this is the way I need to do it. So, this is day two, the second go-round. The first one was desert, and we got an interesting story and a song out of that. That's my laptop you hear shuffling around on the tiny corner of the tiny side table that I am trying to wedge it onto as I work here. I'm kind of wedged into a corner. My guitar is over there on a guitar stand. There's a, like, portable pool table leaned up against the wall. This room is probably 12 feet by maybe 6, probably 5. There's a plant, a kind of Aspidistra type thing. That's a great book, by the way, that Orwell, Keep the Aspidistra Flying, recommended to me by the brilliant Chris Dunlap once long ago. This little Aspidistra that my son has put in here because the room needed some greenery. It has no window, and it is trying to hang on to life underneath this little fluorescent lamp. There are these built-in shelves all the way around the closet, super heavy hardwood shelves that are holding all the books I ever wanted to keep. So that's nice. It's really nice to be surrounded by, like, I'm looking at The Lord of the Rings, Shakespeare, Chaucer, The Iliad, The Odyssey, James Joyce, David Foster Wallace, Martin Amis, Rilke, Lionel Trilling, I'm gonna say her name wrong, but Szymborska, the Polish poet. There's an Oxford English Dictionary over there. This is a nice context in which to work. Anyway, I was supposed to be finding the word of the day. Let's do that. Okay, I'm about to hit the generate random words button. Church. Okay. Church. Church is the word. All right, episode 2, church. The first time we had sex was in the old abandoned church, on the second floor balcony that I wasn't sure was structurally sound, but he insisted was okay, and you had to believe him because his daddy built houses and he'd been around it since he was a baby. The mom was gone, under circumstances he wouldn't talk about. Honestly, I don't know whether the details had been kept from him or whether they were just too horrible to mention. I assume drinking or drugs. It was the late 70s, and a lot of people in our county were falling apart. You know, the promised utopia hadn't come and everyone just had to get on with it. And up here in rural Oregon, that meant heavy times for the former idealists and triumph for all the old I told you so's and such copycat spawn as had been too squeamish to turn on, tune in, and drop out in the first place. It didn't bother me much. The rotting timbers and the desiccated possum remains we couldn't be bothered to sweep out of the corner. I was 17, and this kind of decay was the only way I could accept the grandeur that was architected into the place. And I wanted that grandeur. I did want that, because it was my first time, and it was supposed to matter, and this place was sacred to us. Sure, we'd come in sometimes to find beer bottles and used condoms, but whether we came up on a Saturday night at 10 p.m. or midday on a spring break, we never ran into anyone else here in person. So what if they came? Let it be somebody else's private place, too. We practically lived there that year, our last before college, and it was funny how a place that was fallen so far from its original purpose, slowly being digested by the mushrooms, could offer the protection you needed. Not just shelter from the rain, but love. A kind of cradle or womb for that last fragile flicker of childhood before we got shoved out into the grand, grim adventure. The first time was awful.
Brian was kind and gentle like always, but it hurt like hell. And in spite of all the holiness of the surroundings, or maybe because of the holiness, I went home feeling unclean. I spent like 4 hours in the shower and then the bathtub, autoclaving myself with the hottest water I could stand, bringing out the rosy baby from somewhere underneath all those layers of experience. But after that, it got better. We brought music and candles and old bedding and created a kind of nest in there, listening to Fleetwood Mac and smoking a joint and afterwards just drifting off into some California daydream. The rocking of the waves, the sand and the surf. And then the smell of mildew and the pungent, fertile earth all around would fill my nostrils and I'd think about how the more alive a place is, the more death there has to be in it. I'd think about those mushrooms and their enzymes, silently digesting everything, and I'd think, that's okay. I'm okay with death. I'd rather live in a forest than by the sea. And I knew then that this was our last summer together, but it was all right with me. It wasn't all right with Brian, though. As the summer wore on, he started to tighten, to grow taut. We were going to separate colleges in the fall, but he showed up one afternoon at the church with a date minder. He plopped it open on the pile of comforters and popped open a Pilot V2. Let's plan out next year. Let's make a plan and stick to it. A plan was the last thing I wanted to make. We'll be okay, I said. Don't worry about it. I'm not worried, said Brian. I know enough about life to know that if you don't commit to things, they don't happen. Do you love me or not? I loved him, of course, whatever that meant. I mean, what did it mean exactly? I said, when you put a gun to my head, I don't know what to say. So when I tell you I want to be with you, that's me putting a gun to your head? Lovely. That's really fucking lovely. It was our first and last fight. After that, things just went back to normal. We went back to smoking and laughing and lovemaking, and meanwhile, outside the gray walls, the planet kept spinning inexorably toward the fall. College was a revelation. I was 300 miles away from home, and for the first time in my life, it was like I was able to calibrate the environment to my precise needs. They weren't much, my needs, just a lot of time to spend in the library, one grand space I could accept without even a hint of decay, and a pile of my history books. With every new one I read, I felt like I was steeping in some kind of medicine bath that could draw out of me the poisons of my time and place. I mean, one part of me knew this was stupid. There were plenty of theorists in the curriculum telling me that you can't escape cultural perspective and the power dynamics that made you, but another part of me thought, fuck 'em, I'm stepping outside of myself and it's good for me. Good for anyone. Then Brian showed up. About a month into the first semester, he appeared at my dorm room. I was sharing it with Evelyn, an urban studies major, the kind of person who, unlike me, did not suffer fools gladly, which is another way of saying she could be a total asshole. It's the ambassador from the Army of the Undead, said Evelyn. Brian looked bad. He'd lost at least 50 pounds, and he'd been too skinny to begin with. It looked like he hadn't slept since the tearful farewell in August. His tears, not mine. Let's go for a walk, I said. I didn't need Evelyn in this. We headed into the woods, settled on a bench where I imagined past generations of warm butts supporting conversations about philosophy and engineering, two core strengths of the school. Brian sat there for a long time, staring into the distance, as if looking for someone hidden between the trees. I never went, he finally said. Why not? You, obviously. I just couldn't. Thinking of you up here, doing whatever. His whole body tensed up, fists clenched, jaw tight. For a second, I was sure he was going to hit me. Then he stood up and walked a few yards away. He picked up a rotten log covered with wood ear mushrooms and smashed it to bits against a tree. Then he sort of crumpled into a crouch and started weeping. Except he wasn't really weeping. It was like the sound of a wounded animal, like he wanted to cry but couldn't, and so he was just forcing this horrible sound out of himself. It was difficult to listen to. I didn't know what to do or say, and so after a while, I just left. But Brian didn't. I guess he started sleeping in those woods. Every day when I left my dorm, he'd be there, sitting on a bench, filthy and staring at me with something between longing and hatred. For weeks, I tried to ignore him. I had to. It was evident that whatever had eaten him up inside wanted to do me harm. Meanwhile, he grew stranger, less and less recognizable as the laid-back lover with whom I'd shared that old church, more and more like some malevolent wraith that could not be at rest until I had been denied all earthly happiness. But ignoring him, not knowing what to say to help, was doing a kind of violence to myself. I couldn't eat or sleep. I certainly couldn't read about the Ottoman Empire. all the pashas and viziers and fratricides just blurred one into the next. I skipped my final exams and started hiding out in my room. It was Evelyn who finally got through to me, pulled the duvet off, grabbed me by the shoulders, and literally slapped my face. "What the hell is going on with you? You need to tell me." And then I wept for real, for like half an hour straight without saying anything. And to her credit, Evelyn could be as tender as she was fierce, and she held and rocked me like the baby I'd never be again. And then I started talking, told the whole story, all about the sacred place we'd found together and the abrupt fall from grace and how Brian had just kept falling. Together, we called campus security. I watched from the window as a couple guards helped Brian to his feet. I watched until he disappeared out of sight over the hill, past the spotless, white, non-denominational faith center on the pathway to the main office. I watched until looking away wasn't an act of violence because there was nothing there to see anymore. I felt I at least owed him that. My guest today is the celebrated writer Gish Jen. She's the author most recently of the novel The Resistors, an optimistic, baseball-driven tale of the human spirit set in a techno-dystopian future. Her fiction has been included multiple times in the Best American Short Stories, and she also writes brilliant nonfiction on the divide and overlap of Far Eastern and Western culture.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Okay. So this is your new podcast.
This is my new podcast. You're actually the first guest that I'm talking to.
I'm so honored.
I'm so happy it's you.
Good, good, good. I have this mic sticking right in my face, but other than that, everything is really fine.
I also, as you can see, have one menacingly positioned at near my eye.
Everything is so magical about tech these days. But somehow, you know, the mic thing has not really advanced. I'm sure you've been in a studio. You're trying to talk to somebody. You've got this mic sitting right in your face. It's always very... But do you know what I mean? Like, why hasn't this technology advanced?
The other technology I was going to mention that really needs an upgrade is the umbrella. Especially when you're in a crowded city, it's ridiculous. They are so incredibly bulky. Everyone needs about 3 people's worth of space around them to walk.
They need to be adjustable, you mean?
Or preferably some sort of like invisible force field that just surrounds you at about like 1 inch that keeps the rain off of you.
Yeah, well, while you're doing the force field around the person, you might as well do the whole city, in my view, right? And just have it rain where we want it to rain and not on the people.
There might be some weird externalities about that, though, like people's window gardens that inadvertently die.
That's what the legal system is for, right?
right.
They can go ahead and sue the municipality. It's just like, you know what I mean? And those were my prize tomatoes. Which, you know, the seeds of which came from my grandmother.
So let's start with the crazy non sequitur, which is that in every episode of Clever Creature, there is a word, a single word, that is generated by an algorithm on the internet. I just press a button and a word comes. And then I have to write a story and a song based on that. And what I want to do now is say the word, give you a moment to contemplate it, and then talk about it, you know, whatever it brings up, kind of like a Rorschach test. Does that sound okay?
It depends on what the word is.
Okay, the word is, for this episode, church.
Oh my God. Here's the church, here's the steeple, open your hands to the people, right? Of course. But also the Catholic Church. Of course, I did grow up in the Catholic Church. And so I remember very well those hard pews. I remember the moment that the church went to the vernacular. Do you remember this? When they abandoned the Latin Mass? That was kind of a terrible moment. I actually loved the old Mass. And I remember them sort of trying to be kind of hip. And they started to have services with guitars and so on. I always thought that was really very, very, very poor judgment on their part. Well, of course, I was brought up in the Catholic Church. That meant that, you know, I did take First Communion. I was confirmed. When I chose my confirmation name, you know, of course, I had this, you know, I had all these names. As you know, I had a Chinese name, Bilian. I had this American name, English name, Lillian Jen. I didn't really like either one. But it's interesting. And of course, I went on, as you know, to take a pen name, which is Gish. But before Gish, the first name that I adopted for myself was my confirmation name, and that was Mary. Can you imagine? The world's most boring. Can you imagine? That was the confirmation name that I chose. I wanted to be a saint, you know. And so, if you can imagine, that was an ambition I had to abandon, as you might well surmise today.
What steps did you take toward becoming a saint?
I think I mostly thought about it. You know, I had lots of dreams about, you know, being hung between blocks of ice and being, you know, refusing to renounce the Lord and that kind of thing. I mean, I don't think it affected my behavior in the least. Sadly, you know, I was always getting in trouble, getting thrown out of class and that kind of thing. So it's only in my fantasies that I could possibly have become a saint. Well, I did write about it, by the way, in a story called The Water Faucet Vision some years ago. But I will say that, it, you know, in terms of what this has to do with me today, you know, there's a lot of people like Updike and other people will say that, you know, that the fiction writing particularly is a religious impulse. Updike used to say that, and, you know, Rushdie would say that it, you know, it fills a God-shaped hole in our hearts. And I think there's something about that. You know, it's, I was just, you know, it's funny because of my new book, people have been asking me a little bit about genre fiction. And, you know, we think about why we have this category, literary fiction, you know, what's that, or fiction, which non-commercial fiction, and what's that about? And the answer is, I think that we're talking about a fiction that is related to that God-shaped hole, as opposed to the money-shaped hole.
I think that is so true. And it's interesting, like I wonder, speaking of the money shape, I think about the marketing of literary fiction and sort of in a way how difficult that is, because there's something that's hard to explain about the need that that thing is filling. I think literary fiction is amorphous, ambiguous, and sort of difficult to fit into that kind of box.
Yeah, I think that I think what you're trying to say is it's very uncomfortable to be commodifying it. because it's not a commodity. And, you know, there's a wonderful book about this. Of course, you know, Lewis Hyde's book, you know, The Gift, you know, that talks about
yes.
you know, the creative imagination as being really part of a gift economy rather than a market economy. I think that's definitely part of it. But like I say, I think part of it also is that we do associate the literary with a sacred space, you know, a sacred space. So it's so, you know, so marketing a book, it's like selling your child, you know, and it's definitely uncomfortable. I mean, I think today with literary fiction is in as much trouble as it's in. We understand that, you know, we live in a market economy and we somehow have to make our peace with that. And, you know, that is just a fact. The same way we have to pay our rent, we have to take our garbage out. This is just a fact of life. And, you know, we writers, I think, have by and large more or less gracefully accommodated this imperative. That said, you know, if we were to change the world, one of the first things we would do is to get rid of the fact that books, these sacred objects, you know, have to be sold the way that they do. And don't get me wrong. I mean, actually, I'm at a wonderful publishing house where no one ever talks to me, you know, about changing your ending to make your book more saleable or anything
right.
like that. I mean, never. So it's not like I feel undue commercial pressure day in and day out. That's just not the case. But,
sure.
but there are certain realities. And I think that we all have to do what we can, like I say, to accommodate them.
So I think that's great. I think that's great that that's where we went from church. So this show for me is a creative leap of faith. I'm basically taking things that I've been doing more or less like in the closet for lots of years, music, fiction, things that just haven't been a part of the public life, putting them out there so that I can do more of them because it's something that I love to do. And so I want to ask you about creative leaps of faith in your work, times when you've had to take a risk or give yourself permission to do something that some part of you might not have been sure you were ready to do, but that you also needed to do.
Exhibit A is my new book, The Resistors, right? So here I am, and it was 2017. My daughter had just gone off to college. I was an empty nester for the first time in 30 years. And I did sit down. I did give myself express permission to do whatever I damn well pleased. And one part of what came out was maybe kind of predictable. I mean, I always joke that, you know, I did not use this freedom to write a book about, you know, girls' weekend in Paris involving devastatingly handsome men and designer drugs, right? Instead, I did go on to write a book that, you know, maybe somewhat predictably was about parents watching a daughter grow up and go off into the world. That part was predictable. The part was extremely unpredictable. You know, it was extremely unpredictable was that this would turn into a post-automation surveillance state feminist baseball dystopia. I mean, every single part of that was really very unusual for me. I mean, I had never really thought too much about surveillance. I hadn't thought too much about automation. I'm not a baseball fan. I don't really believe that fiction should be feminist exactly. Like, I don't think it should have any tag like that on it. And I had never really thought about writing a dystopia. And in fact, of course, I was very aware, in fact, that actually dystopias as a form had already been declared out and dead. You know, Jill Lepore had written an article in The New Yorker saying that we're done with dystopias. So, you know, any reasonable person would have thought, Gish, Jen, this is not the project for you. But something about it, you know, it was writing itself, and I just kind of sat down and went with it, even though, like I say, I mean, any rational voice in my head would have said, what? And I will say the first time I talked about this project with my editor, I did make sure that she was sitting down. To this moment, I don't know what came over me. I only know that something about this girl with the golden arm just kind of seized my imagination. And then I had to do everything else because of this girl with the golden arm. And I will say that, you know, my own daughter does not play baseball. Neither does my son. In fact, you know, I always sort of say one of the reasons I had to write about baseball if I was going to write about parenting was that neither one of my kids, you know, has ever made a bat come in contact with a ball. And neither one of them has ever. They cannot catch and they definitely cannot throw. And neither can I. And so that kind of made it a kind of a safe arena for me. Although, of course, I've been obsessed with America and the American experiment from day one. And of course, it is the national pastime. And as the daughter of immigrants, I had kind of a visceral connection to baseball. Because baseball is one of the ways that immigrants first kind of perform their Americanness. One of the first things they do when they're trying to understand America is they go to a baseball game and they have a hot dog. And by the way, you know, the baseball diamond, you know, the field too, that's also a sacred space. You know,
right.
It is a church-like space in which we enact our national rituals. It's a very important place to us psychically.
There's a Paul Simon line in the album Rhythm of the Saints. He says, "The cross is in the ballpark. The cross is in the ballpark." A non-literal poetic line, but I think he's talking about exactly that. The cross shape of the diamond and then also the sacred space.
Well, it's sacred, you know, because all of our democratic ideals are kind of reflected in the ball game. It is our kind of our utopian ideal where, you know, you are part of a team, but the individual gets to shine in this special way. It's a space where we have rules that everyone has agreed upon and rules which, of course, can be rewritten. But and the purpose of the rules is to sort of help us to realize this thing about ourselves, right? The same thing that you're trying to realize now in your podcast. So this is a space that's sort of set up for that, to allow that kind of divine spark to shine forth. And so, you know, right. And I will say, and a lot of these ideas are very strange, you know, to people from other cultures. So there's a way in which the baseball made perfect sense, but truly, you know, I myself in my day-to-day life have nothing to do with baseball. So it was interesting that I could feel all this interest in baseball, even though I was not myself consciously aware of it. If you had asked me when I sat down whether I was interested in or capable of writing a baseball novel, I would have said no bleeping way. Right?
So then, like, entering into this very new territory, the dystopian techno future world that you had to create, everything you had to learn about baseball, I guess, to write it, it's one thing to take the leap of faith, and then it's another thing to navigate the kind of insecurities that might come up along the way, like once you're out on that limb. So like, how did you deal with that? Research, research, research?
Well, of course, research, research, research. Of course, it's not the first time that I was out on a limb that required a lot of research. I mean, I've written about the Cambodians, for instance, and I'm not Cambodian. And I've written about the Jews, and I'm not Jewish, you know. And so I've done it before. And so there is the way in which, having done it before, I knew that if I did enough research that I could get inside this experience. But, you know, much more intimidating for me from a writing point of view is the fact that this is a very well-established genre, the baseball novel, in which many very eminent American writers have distinguished themselves, right? So I'm very aware that, you know, Philip Roth is out there, and Don DeLillo was out there, and Bernard Malamud is out there, and John Updike is out there. We could just go on and on and on, right? And I am aware that I am a woman in guy territory. I am aware that one false step and, you know, it's going to be gotcha, right? That part I can control because, you know, that's just, like, you know, being very careful about your research and so on. But very fundamentally, you have to shut that stuff out. I think from very early on as a writer, I had the habit of making kind of mental icons of various figures who might have something to say about what I was writing, and taking them and literally kind of in my mind making an icon of them and moving them out into the hall and leaving them there, right? And
nice.
And once again, you know, so Don DeLillo, I love your work. Here you go. Out into the hall with you, you know, John Updike, you know, you've been a big supporter and I am so grateful for that. Out into the hall with you as well. And, you know, even all these people, you have to, because if we were to allow them to sit there over my shoulder as I was working, how could anybody possibly work? Do you know what I mean? I mean, this is a huge tradition. I mean, of course you would freeze, you know?
It's the anxiety of influence thing.
Yeah, of course. It's, you know, except for anxiety of influence, you know, you have a desire to kill them, you know? I mean, you know but I don't have the desire to kill any of them. I don't have the murderous feeling.
I wonder if it's not too stereotypical whether it might actually apply to say that killing your heroes is a sort of more masculine archetypal model. Putting them out in the hallway is potentially a more feminine one, which should not necessarily, in fact, I think should definitely not be relegated only to female authors.
That would be a broad generalization, but it's one that we might tentatively make. And
okay.
I will say that, you know, and I will say for what it's worth, you know, we female writers joke about it, you know. So as I once said something about Maxine Hahn Kingston before I'd ever known her, about having to, you know, to kill my ancestors. And when I met her, the first thing she said was, I heard you wanted to kill me. And we had a good laugh about, over it. And I mean, like I say, this is a great example of a trope that was written by men about men. And then when we women are in that situation, we just think the whole thing is hysterical. You know, and in fact, I think that the paradigm, at least in the last generation, was that, you know, the older generation is not so kind to the younger generation. They see them as a threat and they try to keep them down. But, you know, my relationship with Maxine on Kingston has been exactly the opposite. She's been nothing but supportive. And, you know, that kind of tension is just not there. So I do think that there's something about that trope, which is maybe stereotypically men or men from at least the past generation.
I think the last thing that I'll ask is just your thoughts on the value of creativity, of beauty in times like the ones that we're living in right now. I've been thinking a lot lately about how, I mean, your novel is political in some clear-cut ways, but it's also not only political. And I've been thinking a lot how when you come to times that feel sort of revolutionary one way or the other, the question is, once the smoke clears, once the revolution is over, what sort of world will be left? You know, while everyone is feeling the impulse to rush to battle in one way or another, like I think about what the artists, about the fragile impulse to make things that are beautiful, and how that can kind of get steamrolled over in the rush to battle.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that, you know, in the end, we are about some kind of deep reflection, deep thought, the kinds of things that emerge from us when we are in moments of stillness and moments of peace. What's still there? You know, there's a way in which you can argue that a lot of the impulse to do something, to change the world, it's kind of survival oriented, right? You know,
right.
We're just trying to make a world in which, you know, everybody is going to be able to be okay. But actually, art is about more than that. It's about what we care about when we are not worried about survival. And there's a way in which even a political novel like The Resistors, I hope, exhibits qualities that are quite independent of any kind of message or call to arms that you might find in it.
And definitely. Of course,
the book is explicitly concerned with preserving our humanity. You know, it's asking kind of like, you know, with AI, with all these things, you know, where does our humanity lie? And obviously in raising that question, I am concerned about our very humanity, this very spark that you are, you know, you have launched this podcast in order to kind of bring forth. I do think there's a way in which we have some kind of special spark, you know, something that Grant, if you remember the father in the book, when he thinks about his mother, you know, something she says, you know, we have a bigness in us. You know, we have something beyond algorithms and beyond upgrades, something we're proud to call human. And I think that finally art is about expressing that thing, whatever it is that, you know, it's like, yeah, we're like the plants and the animals. We do just return to the earth like they do. But there's something else. And, you know, that might be the biggest delusion of all. But I have to say that in my view, it's a delusion worth having. And finally, art is about art is about that thing. You know, it's not about activism. We have the activism so that we can have the art. But to throw the art out because we're so busy improving the world would obviously be, in my view, an incredible mistake.
And that's a wrap on our main program for episode 2, Church. Please join me 2 weeks from now on June 9th for episode 3, Rally, with the ebullient and brilliant Shima Oliai, producer of the podcast Dolly Parton's America. If you're somewhere where it's convenient to meditate, either sitting or walking, stick around after this for a bonus track guided meditation. It's about 7 minutes long. And please take a minute to rate and review Clever Creature with Jason Gotz on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Himalaya, or wherever you listen. It really, really, really helps the show get noticed.
This meditation is ideally done sitting or standing somewhere without too many external distractions. Some noise around you is not a problem. It doesn't have to be absolutely hermetically sealed or silent, but you want to be in a place where your attention isn't being drawn in too many directions. Find a comfortable posture. It can be helpful to put your chin to your chest and then lift it back up and feel that lengthening in the spine up toward the crown of your head. Sometimes the image is helpful of a string from the crown of your head pulling upward and imagining the rest of your skeleton hanging loosely off that string the way that a shirt or piece of clothing hangs on a coat hanger. The gravity pulling you downward, feeling that comfortable downward pull, and at the same time, a gentle, lively, energetic movement upward. You're looking for a middle ground. Neither too tense nor too loose. Looseness, you know, after a certain point can tend towards sleep or sluggishness, whereas too much energy, too much tension can tend toward anxiety. You want to find that middle ground. Close your eyes or lower them to half mast, as it were, focusing not too intensely on some point in front of you. If your eyes are closed, just letting the eyelids rest loosely. Check in with your body. Is there tension anywhere, any obvious place? Shoulders, chest, in the mask of the face. What energies do you feel in your body at this time? Is there excitement? Is there warmth? Is any part of the body cold? Just noticing with bare attention, making a note. Not trying to figure it out or fix it in any way. Just bare attention. And now begin to notice where the breath is in your body, where you feel the breath most naturally. Most prominently. Is it at the tip of your nostrils? Is it in your chest? Is it in your belly, diaphragm? Wherever the breath is strongest, put your bare, gentle attention there. Don't try to control the breath. Notice if you're doing that. Notice if you're forcing the breath to be more regular than it is, or forcing it to be something other than what it is naturally. Try to just let it be. Notice it as it comes in. Notice it as it goes out. Notice that this thing, which is so essential to you, so essential to your life, always with you, from the moment of your birth to the moment of your death. Is not something that you have to control or worry about or do anything to or with. No productivity required here. No diligence. That right there is your life in its bare essence. Just notice it. And now, the breath in the background. Broaden your attention outward to what you hear around you. Sound of my voice. Sounds of the cars outside or wind. Other people's voices or footsteps. Don't worry about what it is or where it is exactly. Just notice the moment that the sound hits your consciousness. Notice the broad field of consciousness itself. The noticing, the moment when the sound becomes awareness. That awareness is always with you. It's not something you have to do anything to or for or with. No diligence required. It exists before and beyond opinions and identity and worries and past and future. It is always present and aware. And then, when you're ready, you can gently open the eyes. Remaining in this sense of presence and connection as you go about the rest of your day.